أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Verse number 189. يسألونك عن الأهلة قل هي مواقيت للناس والحج وليس البر بأن تأتوا البيوت من ظهورها ولكن البر من اتقى وأتوا البيوت من أبوابها واتقوا الله لعلكم تفلحون. They question you regarding the new moons. Say they are timekeeping signs for the people and for the sake of Hajj. And it's not piety that you come into houses from their rear. Rather, piety is personified by one who is God-weary and come into houses from their doors and be wary of Allah so that you may be felicitous. This is another new topic brought in Surah Baqarah, and it is quoting a question which is put to Prophet. There are 14 or 15 cases where the Quran quotes questions from the Prophet. One of them is here. Several of them are actually in Surah Baqarah, about 7 or 8 of them in Surah Baqarah. The rest are in other surahs, like for example, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْأَنْفَالِ, they ask you regarding Anfal. يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنْ ذِي الْقَرْنَيْنِ, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ السَّاعَةِ, these are the questions which are put to the Prophet. There is one hadith from Abdullah ibn Abbas who says that ما كان قوم أقل سؤالا من أمة محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم سألوا عن 14 حرفا فأجيبوا. There is no ummah who made as little question as our ummah. They only asked 14 questions and they were answered in the Quran. However, this hadith cannot be accepted because the questions asked from the Prophet not always were answered by the verses of the Quran. The Prophet answered many questions to people. It is only some of the verses that Prophet had to wait for the revelation to come, or sometimes they asked in an occasion that revelation was coming and the question was answered by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That is not having 14 or 15 questions only from the Prophet. And sometimes it's not in terms of يسألونك, sometimes it's in terms of يستفتونك. They ask you about your opinion or about God's view on something. So this is a question about the crescents of the moon. يسألونك عن الأهلة. They ask you about, well, the translation says new moon, but new moon has a different meaning. It's about the crescent. And hilal is usually in Arabic said to the crescent which appears on the first night, second night, and some say third night also is called crescent. After that is called qamar. It's not crescent anymore. The 15th, of course, the full moon, is called Badr, but the 2 or 3 nights in the beginning of the month, 2 or 3 months at the end of the month are called Hilal. They don't have names for, as far as I know, for the phases of the moon, as in, for example, in English language, they have crescent, then they have the waxing crescent, waxing gibbous, first quarter, full moon, and then waning, all of these. So they have these phases in English. In Arabic, they should have names for it, but the three names are Hilal, Qamar, and Badr. Now, it is not clear about what did ask about Ahilla. Did they ask about why they happen? Or did they ask about what's the wisdom behind it? Or did they ask about what's the benefit of it for us? The answer actually tells us that the question was not about the existence of these hilals or why it happens, or even what's the wisdom behind it, what's the benefit of it for religious matters, probably. And this is what we have in the answer, that قُلْ هِيَ مَوَاقِيتُ لِلنَّاسِ. And this mawaqit should be mawaqit for performing religious duties. Actually, in a sense, confirming or corroborating the idea that religious mawaqit, the timekeeping of religious matters, should be based on hilal rather than on solar calendar. Of course, moon and sun together, we have in Surah Yunus, I presume, we have this verse that هو الذي جعل الشمس ضياء والقمر نورا وقدره منازل لتعلموا عدد السنين والحساب. He made sun as a shining lamp and moon as a light and set it in different stations so that you know the number of years and also you know calculation of the calendar probably. And it's true, without sun and moon we have no calendar. But without moon we have calendar, we have solar calendar. However, solar calendar is difficult. Ordinary people cannot calculate solar calendar. It needs very complicated calculations. For the moon it's very easy. It's very easy, everyone can see it. And probably one of the reasons that the mawaqit of religious timings are set by moon is because it's very easy. Everyone can understand, can see the hilal, can see the disappearance of the hilal. And this is why we have a hadith from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, who says, قُلْ هِيَ مَوَاقِيتُ لِلنَّاسِ لِصَوْمِهِمْ وَفِطْرِهِمْ وَحَجِّهِمْ. It's all for these religious matters. That shows, apparently the question was about what's the relation between halal and our religious duties that we perform. Now, one particular duty is mentioned here, among others, which is Hajj. يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْأَهِلَّ قُلْ هِيَ مَوَاقِيتُ لِلنَّاسِ وَالْحَجِّ. And apparently, it's a preparation for the following verses, which talks about qital and jihad and fighting. And of course, we know in the months of Hajj, jihad and fighting is not permissible. Then, because Hajj is mentioned, something which was actually a customary practice of some of the tribes of Quraysh at that time is mentioned, which was these tribes were called Homs, and Homs means from Hamas and Hamasa, meaning zealous. The more zealous people in their faith, when they wanted to go Hajj, they added something to it to show, of course, their great dedication to faith and to their faith. And that was when they came back, they said, we do not go into our houses from the same door that we went for Hajj, that we went for. Now we have done our ihram. This is, of course, at the time of Shirk, at the time of Jahiliyyah, because Hajj was performed very, very meticulously by Mushrikun. So at that time, they thought that when we go and put on ihram and perform our Hajj, we come back, we do not go inside our houses from the same door. So they made a hole in the back of their house, in the furthest part of their house at the back, and entered from there. And you can imagine many customs had probably developed around that. People were gathering there when the hole was made, and there were builders and other things coming and doing this business, and people entered from that part. Now, here it says, وَلَيْسَ الْبِرُّ بِأَنْ تَأْتُوا الْبُيُوتَ مِنْ ذُهُورَهَا. It's not piety. So this was a sign of piety. This was a sign of full dedication to faith. It is not part of piety to come into your houses from the back door. وَلَكِنَّ الْبِرَّ مَنِ اتَّقَى. But bear is someone who fears, of course, he fears God, fears committing muharramat, fears committing what God has, violating what God has confirmed. Of course, there are other meanings for this I'll mention shortly, but one of the things here is that some of us try to add things to rituals which are given to us by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, thinking that this makes us more dedicated than other people. And I think this verse is not only for them who did such a very funny act in the time of Jahiliyyah. It's for us as well now. Sometimes we think that last week, the week prior to that, I think you mentioned about khandaq and such things that they make. This is for very, very zealous people who want to feel that they are very zealous about Imam Hussein. They walk on the fire. Well, lays albir. This is not piety to do this. Piety is you do not violate what Allah has ordered you to do, not what you make as a sign of piety, what you make as a sign of dedication to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the act is similar, of course. I don't want to condemn those who do it. They do it out of their zeal and out of their dedication. But what here is emphasized is that when you add something as a sign of dedication, it is not piety. It's not regarded as piety by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Piety is وَلَكِنَّ الْبِرَّ مَنِ اتَّقَى. Someone who fears to violate muharramat of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَلَكِنَّ الْبِرَّ مَنِ اتَّقَى. وَأْتُ الْبُيُوتَ مِنْ أَبْوَابِهَا. Come to your houses from their doors. وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهِ. And only, of course, fear to violate what Allah has mentioned for you as your rituals. There is one hadith which is reported from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, and it's mentioned in Majmu' al-Bayn, Ayashi, in Mahas, in other books as well. He says, Ya'ni, this ليس البر بأن تأتوا البيوت من ظهورها, يعني أن يأتي الأمر من وجهه أي الأمور كان. It's not limited to this. It means whatever you want to do it from its proper way. Don't do it from the convoluted ways, for example. So, for example, when we want to venture on scientific exploration, we do it in a scientific way, not philosophically we try to solve scientific problems, or vice versa. So anything you want to do, do it from its proper way. And one of the, as our Aima has mentioned, and many Shia commentators have mentioned as well, one of the most outstanding examples of this is from who you get your religious edicts, who you go to ask for your religious, for your faith, for your religious practice and belief. And this is what has come from in many of narrations. What Faiz Kashani says here is that وَمِنْهُ, one of the instances of this, doing things from its proper way, أخذ أحكام الدين عن أمير المؤمنين عليه السلام وأثرته الطيبين. Taking our knowledge of faith, whether it's belief or practice, from أمير المؤمنين. Because لأنهم أبواب مدينة علم النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم. These are the gates, the doors of knowledge of the Prophet, as the Prophet said, أنا مدينة العلم وعلي بابها ولا يؤتى المدينة إلا من بابها. You should not enter the city except through the gates. Now, of course, here, وَأْتُ الْبُيُوتَ مِنْ أَبْوَابُهَا has a very close similarity to come to the city from the gates of the city. And it shows that taking knowledge, whether it's fiqh or whether it's belief, from scholars who disagree with A'imma alayhi salam is not permissible, or it's not taqwa. It's not permissible, it's not taqwa for someone who has this knowledge of course, imamah. There are people who don't have this knowledge, of course, they take it and they practice. But someone who has this knowledge of imamah and knows the door, the gate of the city, then it's not permissible for them to take knowledge from anyone else. And we have many narrations in this regard. From Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam, قَدْ جَعَلَ اللَّهُ لِلْعِلْمِ أَحْلَى. Allah has made for knowledge certain people which are possessors of that knowledge. وَفَرَضَ عَلَى الْعِبَادِ طَاعَتَهُمْ, and has made people to follow them. By this verse, وَأْتُ الْبُيُوتَ مِنْ أَبْوَابَهَا, come to the houses from their doors. وَالْبُيُوتِ هِيَ بُيُوتَ الْعِلْمِ الَّذِي اسْتَوْدَعَتْهُ الْأَنْبِيَاءُ وَأَبْوَابُهَا الْأَوْسِيَاءُ. The buyut, the houses are houses of knowledge, the knowledge that Anbiya has left for their awsiya. And also another hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, نَحْنُ الْبُيُوتِ الَّتِي أَمَرَ اللَّهُ أَنْ يُؤْتَى مِنْ أَبْوَابُهَا. We are the houses that Allah has commanded you have to go from its doors. And also, finally, another hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, who said, Alu Muhammad, salawatullah alayhim, abwabullah wa subuluhu wa du'atu ila al-jannah wa al-qadatu ilayha. Alu Muhammad are the gates of Allah. Well, we have in many other narrations that A'imma are Babullah. When we say Babullah, it doesn't mean that Allah has a gate and you have to go to ask them rather than Allah or make an appointment from them. It means that if you want to know God and what are your duties towards God, you go to these Abwab, ask them. So sometimes we confuse between the two. These are two completely different matters. When we say Babullah, something that you cannot directly go to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you have to go through them. That's a different matter whether it's correct or not correct. But here, especially Babullah means someone who knows about God and can teach us what are the qualities of God, what are our duties towards Allah. This is the meaning of Babullah. Verse 190 starts to talk about qital and jihad. And they say this is probably one of the first verses which allows Muslimun to start fighting against the mushrikeen. وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ وَلَا تَعْتَدُوا. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُحِبُّ الْمُعْتَدِينَ. Fight in the way of Allah, those who fight you, but do not transgress. Indeed, Allah does not like transgressors. Now, as I said, this either the first or one of the first verses, because we have another verse in Surah Hajj, which probably has been revealed after this. And that is أذن للذين يقاتلون بأنهم ظلموا وأن الله على نصرهم لقدير. For those who want to wage jihad, permission is issued because they have been wronged, and Allah is powerful in helping them. Now the point about this verse is that some of the exegetes say that this verse is abrogated; it is mansukh. Why they say it's abrogated? Because there is a condition here which Muslims did not observe after the Prophet. Now, whether they did not observe after the Prophet because it is mansukh, or they did not observe it after the Prophet because it was not it was not expedient. And that is, قَاتَلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ, those who fight you. So it means that fighting should be defensive. If no one fights you, you do not fight. And this, of course, does not tally with what we saw after the Prophet in the conquests which happened and Islam spread by moving from all directions in the name of jihad. So, what is our position here? It says that only you can fight those who fight you. قاتلوا في سبيل الله الذين يقاتلونكم ولا تعتدوا. Do not transgress. Now, this do not transgress may actually explain. In Tafsir al-Safi, Faiz Kashani says, لا تعتدوا means بابتداء القتال. Do not begin fighting. This is it. This is transgression. If you begin fight, this is transgression. والمفاجأة به من غير دع. Or you start a battle without calling people to Islam. This is what most of the Sunni scholars as well say. It means that when you want to go and fight a people, first call them to Islam. If they do not accept, then fight them. However, this doesn't come to a sensible meaning, because when you go to the battlefield or when you speak with kings, you are not calling the people, you are talking with politicians. And this is not actually calling the people at the beginning. So he says this i'tida, transgression, is initiating the battle. وَالْمُفَاجَأَةُ بِهِ مِنْ غَيْرَ دَعْوَةٍ, or starting it without calling, and also doing certain things in the battlefield, which is transgression, like مُثْلَة, which is amputating or cutting into pieces the dead bodies, وَقَتْلُ مَنْ نُهِيتُ مَنْ قَتْلِ, and killing those that who are not allowed to kill, like women, children, old people, or those who do not take part in battle, the civilians, all these are transgression from the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Fakhruddin Razi says that, of course, there are a lot of scholars who say that this ayah is mansukha. With the following ayah, وَاقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ تَقِفْتُمُهُمْ. This is very strange. We will discuss about that later, about the kill them wherever you find them. This is after you start battle. When they fight you, of course, then you do not stop as soon as, for example, one battle is finished. When the war is going on, you have to fight them and kill them, of course, wherever you find them. Otherwise, they gather force and come back again. They say this verse is mansukh with the following verse. However, he says, even if you do not say it's mansukh, it doesn't mean that you are not allowed to begin a fight, begin a war, because la ta'tadu only means do not transgress in battlefield. Now, Allama Tabatabai has a view on this. We'll, inshallah, mention that next week when we come to the next verse, which says that وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ, kill them wherever you find them. And this is one of those verses that is mentioned in the media very much, and you hear that, yes, Muslims say, wherever you find kuffar, kill them. Now, Allama Tabatabai has a very, very interesting view on this, but what is the Shi'i view, before going to that, about what they call it al-jihad al-ibtida'i, initiating a fight, a war? Not even for the sake of da'wah. Is it permissible? Is not or it is not permissible? Now here, the history, the seerah of the Khulafa has been that they initiated battles, they initiated wars to call people to Islam. We had lots of conquests, and many of those conquests, of course, we know was not for Islam. Especially at the time of the Umayyads, at the time of the Abbasids, they were not for Islam. They were for land. For land, for booties, for money, for power. So we cannot approve of that. One of the reasons is that Imam Ali, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam, never took part, although they were always in jihad. Imam Ali was always in jihad at the time of the Prophet, peace be on him. Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam were always in jihad beside Imam Ali in Safin and Nahrawan and other places, but they never took part in any of the wars which were for conquering other lands or calling people to Islam. And despite the fact that especially the Khulafa were very eager to motivate Imam Ali to go to battlefield, to go and fight. First of all, it was a sign of approval of those battles. And secondly, it was a sort of confirmation of Jihad al-Ibtidai. They never. We have some narrations, some historical accounts that Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein took part in the wars in Tabaristan, in the northern Persia. However, we can understand why these accounts were forged. Only two people have mentioned this. One is Baladuri in Futuhul Buldan, who says that such companions were in the fight in Tabaristan. And then he says, وَيُقَالُ, and it is said. It was very interesting. A historian who's recording the history in a very clear way says, وَيُقَالُ, and it is said that Hassan and Hussein alayhi salam also took part in that battle. Well, this is, of course, without any value, because he doesn't know himself. He said that they took part. The other person who has mentioned this is Tabari. And interestingly, he has mentioned the same hadith twice. In one hadith, he mentions that Hassan and Hussein took part. In another hadith, he doesn't mention them. And this shows that this is an addition after Tabari. It's not Tabari who has mentioned this. The reason why they wanted to show that Hassan and Hussein took part in the battle in Tabaristan, and only in Tabaristan, nowhere else, was because later on the Umayyad and Abbasid had a hard time with Tabaristan because they had become Shia of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And they wanted, in a sense, to tell them, look, you are following Imam Ali, while Hassan and Hussein took part in those brutal battles, which killed many of you, and of course, called in the call to Islam, they took part. So this is also this account also has no value, as I said, because Tabari mentions the same hadith with the same sanad twice in his book. One of them has it, one of them doesn't have it. It shows someone added it, and he actually had not noticed that Tabari has mentioned this in another place as well. Forgot to add these two in that hadith as well. So, if this is the case, can we deduce from this that these holy people were not agreeing with these battles, with these conquests? And if this is true, then it puts all the conquests which happened after the Prophet, and especially, as I say, especially because at the time of Caliph Omar and Uthman, the companions were there. But at the time of the Umayyads and Abbasids, it was just for the conquest of land. Can we say that something went wrong and it was not permissible for them to do that, especially with the with this verse, وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ, only those who fight you. The fatwa of Shi'i fuqaha is very interesting here. And they say the battle, the initial jihad, initiating jihad without being attacked, is only permissible at the time of Ma'sum. No one else can do that. Although we have a minority of fuqaha who say that it is permissible for faqihul jami' li sharayat. If there is a faqih in charge and has all the conditions of taqwa, piety, justice, knowledge, political acumen and all these things is permissible, but this is minority. These minority, of course, are credible people. For example, Sheikh Tusi does not allow it. He says in the time of Ma'asum it's not permissible, but his student Sheikh Mufid allows it. We have Sheikh Mufid, people like Sallar, his students allowed it, but apart from that, majority would not allow this, and this is what Tabrasi says here. Tabrasi here says that in Majmu' al-Bayan, in the view of Shi'i fuqaha, it is not allowed to initiate battle unless we have the ma'asum in charge. Among the contemporary fuqaha, it may be interesting to know that Ayatollah Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, is against it, says it's only for the time of ma'asum. And Ayatollah Khoi says, no, faqihul jama' al-sharaat can initiate a fight. You would have thought it should be the other way around, but this is, of course, what they have deduced from what they have read and what they have understood from them. Did Prophet, peace be on him, start any battle? Apparently, Prophet as well did not start any battle. Yes, there were preemptive moves by the Prophet, like, for example, going to Tabuk because he heard that they are gathering force. He didn't raid the land. He didn't take any land. He just went there on the borders, stopped there, and when, of course, they were scared and scattered, he came back. Yes, preemptive moves is allowed. Or if we know that some country or some people want to attack and we preempt and go attack them, this الَّذِينَ يُقَاتَلُونَكُمْ doesn't mean just in battlefield. If they are gathering force to attack you, yes, you have the right to preempt and stop that. Otherwise, the Prophet did not do it. Was it allowed to Prophet to do it? Now, we have one case in the Quran which shows that some prophets, some of the Ma'asumin, took this initiation of call. And that is the story of Suleiman and Queen Sheba, isn't it? That, of course, there was no provocation from Yemen, from Queen Sheba. Only Suleiman, alayhi salam, heard that they're worshipping sun, the sun. And he sent them a letter that, Allah ta'alu alayya wa atuni muslimin, do not resist before me and submit to me. And you know the story. However, again, that should be investigated further to see why, particularly Yemen, while there were many other idolaters around Suleiman, why particularly he wanted to attack Yemen. It is a probability that because Yemen had a sort of huge hegemony over Jaziratul Arab and northern parts of Hejaz, it may have been a possibility that, again, it was a sort of preemptive action. At any case, up to, if we are in this verse, and if we do not say that it's mansukh, as many, especially Sunni scholars have said, that is mansukh. If it's only us and this verse, initiating jihad with mushrikeen is not permissible. Because he said, وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ وَلَا تَعْتَدُوا إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُحِبُّ الْمُؤْتَدِينَ. Now, when we come to the following verse then, فَاقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ وَأَخْرَجُوهُمْ مِنْ حَيْثُ أَخْرَجُوكُمْ. There are more, it sheds more light on what this means. Inshallah, we leave that for next week. وَصَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَىٰ مُحَمَّدٍ وَعَلَىٰ طَاهِرِينَ.
اللَّهُمَّ صَلِّ عَلَىٰ مُحَمَّدٍ وَعَلَىٰ. Thank you, Shaykh. Very interesting. Brothers and sisters, now we have 15-20 minutes to further discuss and clarify any points. Any brothers, sisters? No, okay, then I'll start with Sheikh. Only a couple of, talking about transgressing in the holy war, a couple of days ago I heard in Urdu Majalis that one of the battle, I think it was, he mentioned, if I'm not forgetting, Battle of Khaybar, when the enemies were defeated and one of the high profile enemy was killed by Imam Ali, he went and decapitated his head and went towards the Prophet to show him that that time Ja'far-e-Tayyar was retiring from, after a long time, from Yemen. Now, is that possible?
From Abyssinia.
From Abyssinia. Is it possible, Imam Ali, to decapitate a dead person?
Well, they had to decapitate.
Is it?
If they did not decapitate, in many battles, of course, it was to somehow terrify the enemy, to deter them from making more assault. However, this was only when they had these hand-to-hand battles, single battle combat, so to speak. They fought individually against each other. When, of course, the war was between armies and there were many casualties or many dead, after that it was not permissible to chop the heads. It was only on that occasion that to show to the enemy that this man is killed, this what had happened. However, again, we have to see, we have to investigate whether these are true stories or not.
Because to my mind, it is still unacceptable. Anyway,
you have know. You ever been to war?
No, I've been to war. for an Imam Ali or some of his caliber to look like that, to sort of treat somebody, a dead
you
person
see,
like
here
that.
Here it said one of the cases of i'tida is muthla, and muthla is one instance of muthla is to decapitate. Decapitate is muthla. It's not permissible. Okay. However, if there is a reason for it, like when in single battle they had to chop the head to show to the enemy that the man is killed, and this happened when the great warriors were killed, and it would have been like a defeat for them, it would have made a justification for it.
Okay, thanks. So let's move forward. Any brothers, sisters? Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh.
So
I know this, you are trying not to get into the quagmire, because reading the four verses together, it might be that at the time of the Umayyads, they actually used these verses to very good effect against anybody who had an uprising. And of course, we all know about the biggest uprising there. So it's I'm actually fearful of going down this path to start this discussion just now.
No, the following verses, let us discuss them next week.
Of course, yes, of course.
Because actually the following verses explain this more clearly.
Much clearly, yeah. Yes. So I'm trying to see whether there's a link between 188 and 189. Because we said, do not eat up each other's property by false means. And then we said about the authorities might help you do that.
So we can say
the new moon is not that important to this discussion, but it goes on to say it is not righteousness that you come to your houses from their back.
It is important, the new moon as well is important in this discussion, because especially when it says hiya mawaqitu lin-nas wal hajj, because months of hajj were months of no war, no fighting, okay, and therefore actually, one of the exodus here, Fakhruddin Razi, mentions that the best explanation for this, why Hajj is mentioned here, is by Ghaffal al-Shashi, a 4th century exegete, who says that because Allah has prohibited war in those months, and the kuffar used to somehow sometimes postpone this hurma to other months to continue fighting in these months. This was nasi, innama nasi'u ziyadatun fil kufr. It is in increase in kufr. So yes, in that sense, it is related to the following verses.
So there is no connection that I can see.
Yeah, maybe it's because of the noise. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So I can't see the connection between the Hajj. That's fine. It stands as an edict in its own about the fighting. But they go into the doors from the back. I'm not sure if the reason you mentioned was the only one. Is there any other reason mentioned for this particular verse about entering the houses from the front? Is it possible that there's another explanation?
No one has mentioned any other explanation, but always there are possibility of other explanations. But no exegetes have mentioned any other explanation.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any sisters? Sisters? Riaz? Riaz, can you pass the mic?
Thank you very much for today's lecture. I'm particularly grateful I was here today to hear the explanation of the latter part of verse 189. It's absolutely beautiful in terms of people understanding.
Only fighting those who fight you.
Well, about the entering from
the back door. 88, yes. Okay. Yeah.
And it's very clear, isn't it?
Yes.
The authority of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam is beautifully clear. I mean, you don't even have to think too long to able to understand that. Not that I would have done without your help, but ultimately it doesn't take a huge scholarly activity to actually understand what
Absolutely.
It is, especially in the context and
yes.
you know, and then and the following hadith which happened, and everyone accepts it. So it's a recurring question, Sheikh, and there might not be an answer, but given this very clear explanation, given the fact that it's so clear, it's like the sun shining on you, why don't people accept this? Why are there people who are? Why is everybody in the world not a follower of the Amir? I can't understand it. I mean, there are people who we meet regularly on occasions, and we've had people come here, and they talk about the love for the Ahlul Bayt. They talk about, you know, the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. They talk about Hadith al-Thaqalain. They talk about everything from their sources.
Mm.
Why is there a barrier?
Well, this is why Fatima, peace be on her, was so outraged and amazed, isn't it? That why are you doing these things, having heard all these narrations from the Prophet, everything in the Quran, why are you doing this? So, what can we say?
There's many sisters. No, a brother. Yeah, can you pass the mic?
Thank you.
Based on verse 190, how would you go about spreading Islam? So would you...
Sorry, my apologies. Yeah, so based on verse 190, how would you go about spreading Islam? So I want to invite the people of China to Islam. I contact the king. He says, take a hike. What would you do? Is that transgression?
You mean you go and fight the people of China?
We're not allowed to transgress in war. They haven't attacked us, but I want to spread Islam into a new land.
Well, some of the exes here have mentioned that the only way to spread Islam is to somehow spread the word, not by fighting. And even the conquests, you know, the conquests were not very instrumental in conversion. Conversion was something happened later due to people's willingness. I mean, for example, we had the conquest of Spain by Umayyads. Did it help at all to convert people to Islam? It didn't. And as soon as they found power, they actually obliterated all traces of Islam from their culture, isn't it? In Persia, people were willing to do it. They were tired of their kings and others. And the rate of conversion after conquest was so huge. I mentioned this before. The second caliph issued an edict to his commanders in Persia that do not accept conversion, because we cannot deal with it here in terms of our bookkeeping. Because when they convert, they come from paying jizya to paying zakat, and that made lots of bookkeeping change and all these things. So this is a document that Umar wrote to his commander, do not accept conversion, and we do not want any more conversion in Persia. Regard them as just Ahlul Jizya and Ahlul Kitab. So you see, the conquest itself is not very helpful. And imagine if now, for example, we find power and we go and fight people of China to force them to Islam. If they are not willing, if they do not accept the beauty of Islam, would they convert? No, they only fight us. And we would only kill each other. So it may not be the best way to convert people.
Take any sisters? Sisters? Any brothers? So does it mean that, Sheikh, that it may not be wrong to say that the Islam was spread by this sword, was it?
I don't think it is spread. It was spread by sword at all. No? I mean, there were lots of conquests, but conversions were not because of those conquests. For several reasons. First of all, those countries who were actually conquered, they were not mushrikun, they were mostly Ahlul Kitab. They could have kept their faith. But they liked to convert to Islam. And like Persia, I mean, the majority of the scholars in fiqh, in hadith, in Quran, these reciters, this Al-Ghurra al-Sab'a, four of them are Persians, you see. They came by all their heart into Islam. I don't think conquests were very instrumental. And we have certain cases like Indonesia, in which there was no war at all, and they all converted because of businessmen going there and spreading Islam.
Initially, like, I mean, there was a conquest to capture land, so in a way, indirectly trying to spread Islam, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Okay. Sisters? No? Brother Riaz? Yeah.
From the conquests with weapons, let's switch to something that happened from love, from what I hear from the pulpit, that Iran or parts of it were converted to Shia because of love, because there happened to be the ruler at that time was inclined towards the faith of saying that you cannot remarry the same woman, I think, if I remember hearing it a few years ago. It's about the king who was given a solution into his marriage.
These are Mongols actually converting to Shia, not Persians. This was that was the Mongol king who sought solution from Allama Helli about remarrying his wife who he had divorced three times in one majlis.
That's the one, yes.
So that was about Mongols, and it was Mongol king, actually. That's a different story, but Persia.
I've actually heard that parts of Iran were converted because of this. And of course, I mean, it's Madlismi, right? So he's saying that parts of Iran were converted. Like, so I'm just comparing that people spread Islam by the sword. And here, Islam was spread by love, if you know what I mean. So obviously, we all know the spreading of Islam has got to be through character. You have to exemplify your character. You have to spread yourself. Show your character amongst the people about integrity, honesty, and caring for your community. And obviously, that's where the Salaam Center comes in as well. Yeah. Thank you.
Inshallah, thank you for publicizing Salaam Center. But next week, when we discuss the whole verses together, and when we see the view of Allama Tabataba, it becomes more clear what these verses mean, inshallah.
Thank you, any sisters?
Assalamu alaikum. Ahsantum, Sheikh. Do you not believe that this verse actually can be reinterpreted in the 21st century? I mean, this is the thing about, you know, I'm really thinking about how we actually comprehend the Quran in the 21st century. And there are, you know, various verses that, of course, only it was applicable at that particular time, because that was the norm, that was the way to spread Islam, is, you know, it's through battles. This is the culture, this was the philosophy of what people actually understood, was, you know, the battles at that time. And if we were to live at that particular time, then battles would be the norm. You know, this is the way that we actually engage in spreading Islam or in dua. But in the 21st century, we can perhaps take this particular verse and apply it to what is the philosophy of spreading knowledge? What is the philosophy of, or the methodology of comprehending these particular things? And I find that, and you know, we can interpret this as you know, perhaps the social media of our life. You know, rather than the using the sword. You know, wala ta'tadu, you know, the using social media, but with caution. You know, لا تعتدوا on social media as well. You know, the issue of trying to, of course, have the best of akhlaq, the best of ethics, while we do da'wah Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and of course through lectures and all the means that are acceptable in the 21st century to do da'wah. And I think that, for me, it's important we touch on, because, of course, these verses can be you know, misinterpreted. People can, of course, can say, you know, at this particular time, this is what, of course, Daesh and others have taken on board. And what I think what we have to do is, I'd love to hear your view on this, is apply this particular verse, but with the methodology and the philosophy used in our time now.
Well, very interesting thing you mentioned, and that is when we take this battle to media, we should bear in mind لا تعتدوا, do not transgress. And not transgressing here means, of course, do not lie, do not exaggerate, do not try to accuse wrongly your opponents. It's, I think this is very clear. And also it comes in other verses, like, for example, ادعو إلى سبيل ربك بالحكمة والموعظة والموعظة الحسنة وجادلهم بالتي هي أحسن. جدال الأحسن means there should be no lies, no accusations, not seeking through batil means to prove a haq, a cause. These are all true. However, even if we take these verses literally, even today it does not allow us to fight unless we are attacked. And today, if you are attacked, of course we have to fight, isn't it? And especially, for example, the following verse, which says, أخرجوهم من حيث أخرجوكم. They drove you out of your lands, so go and take it back. So this is, in a sense, something that universally is acceptable by all moral values, that if a people are attacked, they have the right to defend themselves. If people are driven out of their homes, they have the right to go and fight for it. So I think they are still applicable. But yes, today we have a new battle on another ground, and that is on media and in a sort of philosophical arguments and such things. And that عدم الاعتداء, of course, applies there very nicely, I think. Thank you.
Thank you. Any sisters? Any brothers? Last one? No? Thank you, Sheikh Muhammad Wa Al Muhammad Salwat. We continue next week, inshallah.